This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to talk with former president of the National Lawyers Guild, Peter Erlander, on the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act.
Is this a new effort to set up a House Un-American Activities Committee like they had in the 50s?
We'll talk with the author of a book called Torture and the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad.
Torture has less to do with getting information than it does to do about declining empires, from France and Algeria to the United States in Baghdad.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Michael, this sounds like something from the Nixon era. Tell us about the destruction of the videotapes by the CIA. What's it about?
It was just recently revealed by the New York Times that in November 2005, the CIA destroyed not one, not two, not three, but hundreds of hours of videotapes. Tapes of apparently three waterboarding interrogations, including one of a man named Abu Zubaydah. Hundreds of hours of waterboarding tapes. And all of a sudden, there's a huge conflagration about this destruction of tapes. Of course, one of my perspectives is, why hasn't there been a huge set of criticisms about the fact that we're doing waterboarding or water torture? But let's leave that aside for a second. Let's look at what's really happened here with the tapes. The first thing is, was it illegal to destroy the tapes? And of course, there's no doubt it was illegal. There's particular statutes that require you to keep that kind of information if they're needed for trials, criminal trials, the 9/11 Commission, our Guantanamo detainees. And in fact, one fact that rarely gets out there, in January 2005 and shortly thereafter, we got an order from the federal court in most of our Guantanamo cases, if not all, and was sent to Porter Goss, head of the CIA at the time, Mueller, who was head of the FBI, saying they had to preserve all evidence of abuse and torture with regard to the Guantanamo detainees. And not just at what happened at Guantanamo, but any evidence that might be used against them. And of course, one of the problems here is now you have these tapes destroyed. Those guys probably said a million things. They may have implicated tons of people who probably had nothing to do with anything. And now we'll never know whether the evidence came essentially from torture tapes. So the first thing to understand here, we already in our Guantanamo cases had a preservation order for torture. The 9/11 Commission wanted these tapes. Various congressional committees wanted these tapes. Two trials, at least, Padilla's case and Moussaoui's case, had asked for tapes like this. In the face of this, the CIA went ahead and destroyed hundreds of hours of tapes. So you have to ask yourself, what was really going on here? I was on a call yesterday with a number of people. We were discussing this. And of course, the CIA's excuse was, we were afraid of having the identities of the CIA agents revealed because that would put them into danger. But of course, that's BS, because you can always
blackout parts of the faces.
The other two reasons, the one I really thought was the most likely, is since the beginning of the torture program post 9/11, very early on, the government has been very afraid, the Bush administration, of criminal prosecution. So this is like flat out there, criminal prosecution. It has the people, the observers who are actually in these interrogations, the people in the interrogations. And I got a note the other day that some people said it was widely believed at the time that Rumsfeld himself may have observed some of these some of these interrogations. We can't prove that, but it was at least a widespread belief that Rumsfeld may have been involved in this. He was certainly involved in authorizing it. Whether he was in the room and on the tapes, I doubt, but that's, we've heard that. So my theory was always avoid criminal prosecution. The other theory that was put forth on by a journalist yesterday who I was speaking to was, you think Abu Ghraib was bad? When it comes out as photographs, you can imagine what this would have done to the United States and the Muslim world, 200 hours of videotapes of Muslim men being waterboarded, essentially. And also, not just all being waterboarded, the recovery from waterboarding apparently is part of it while they're in their cells. So it's obviously a huge scandal. But, you know, what was said to me yesterday, I'm interested in your thoughts, yesterday was that, again, this is going to be a situation where the Bush administration and the CIA felt they were better off with no tapes and the scandal that would come about with no tapes than they were with actually the scandal that would come about with the tapes. And they made a calculated decision, let's destroy them and we'll deal with the fallout and we'll get the usual thing. We'll get Senator Leahy writing a letter complaining. We'll get the congressional people having some hearings. We'll get more and more and more. And on top of this, then we see a picture in the New York Times on Wednesday. And what it is that it's Mukasey standing in front of a flag and a shield, you know, of whatever he runs now. I guess he's the attorney general, unfortunately, saying he still is not sure waterboarding is torture. There you go. You have the whole story right there.
Yeah, Cheney's not sure either. He says waterboarding, it's a no-brainer for me. But I think you're absolutely right, Michael. I think that by destroying the tapes, as bad as it looks, it ain't as bad as it would have looked if those tapes were viewed. And it also gives Bush deniability. Bush says, what did I know? I didn't know until General Michael, the head of the CIA, told me yesterday. That's what Bush says. And there was an interesting article, we both read it, from a British newspaper about how they think that Bush actually knew that these orders to do this enhanced interrogation techniques came from the very top down.
Well, I agree. It would have been just a scandal to have these tapes on YouTube, shown all over the world. I want to ask, if this administration knew that this would be such a scandal were the tapes shared around the world, why did they videotape these proceedings in the first place?
That's a very good question. I mean, you know, one thing that comes to mind, although you don't know, is that they videotaped them to humiliate them even more. One, the fact that it's being recorded, of course, is a humiliation immediately. There could also be a coercive reason. They could use those tapes to either show those people and say, we're going to show these tapes to the world or show them to other people unless you become essentially an agent for us or spill all the beans, whatever the beans are, if there's any. Or they could show them to other people they have in custody and say, you see what happened to your leaders? They were tortured. They were waterboarded. Here's what they said. If you don't, you will be waterboarded. They've already given it up. It's time for you to, as a way of getting the other side, the people to just cave in. Very possibly the explanation for these tapes has to do with the continuation of the interrogation process. So there may be more tapes.
Wouldn't it be great
there.
If we had a whistleblower who actually had some of those additional tapes who came forth with them?
Well, this guy that Michael is talking about that was in the article in the UK, he says he was a former CIA agent who was involved, if not directly, but peripherally in these interrogations. And he says a couple of things that are interesting. One, he says it goes all the way to the top. He also said he considers it to be torture. We shouldn't do this again. But he also says he thought it was okay to do it at the time. He claims we got valuable information from Zubeda. On the other hand, if you read James Risen's book, Wiretapping and All This Stuff, Risen has a quote in his book that nothing valuable was gotten out of any of this. So that's my guess.
I think they taped it because they're always trying to improve their torture techniques.
Michael, that sounds right. I'll tell you. Go ahead.
Way back, Michael, remember, Heidi, when we interviewed Al McCoy, who wrote that great book on how the CIA spent hundreds of millions of dollars and enlisted the top universities in America, plus McGill, a top university in Canada, in the 50s to perfect torture techniques that wouldn't show any marks. And they've perfected it. And I think that they're on this endless quest to make it even better.
Well, in a very kind of demented perspective, one could also say that there's a kind of pride. I think it's going to relate to a future guest of ours who wrote Torture and the Twilight of Empire, in that it's the ultimate dominance, the show of dominance by one culture over another.
Yeah, she ends her book making that precise point, Heidi, and we'll have a chance to interview her and play that interview, I think, as a companion to our discussion here.
I want to make one more point about all of this. You know, as I said, it's a scandal that right now, of course, you know, mostly has hit the executive, the CIA, but there were some articles, and it's come out, although not getting the prominence, about the role of Congress in this. And it's really astonishing, because what the article that came out in the Washington Post, Nancy Pelosi, Jane Harman, a couple of other Democrats, a couple of Republicans, I think maybe four people altogether, maybe six, actually had notice of the waterboarding or water torture, as it should be called, in 2003. There were four people talked, and once they were told about the waterboarding, and that according to Porter Goss, who was a congressman at the time, they didn't say a peep, and some of them actually encouraged it. Nancy Pelosi apparently said nothing about it. Jane Harman, at least to some credit, wrote a letter to the CIA saying, what are you guys doing? But Pelosi, complete silence. Pelosi has now responded to that article by saying, well, a year later or sometime later, I did write a letter to the CIA. So let's think about that for a while. What this is really about, and we've all known about it, everybody's known about water torture. This is really about being caught a little bit with your hand in the cookie jar, because now they know the public is, you know, can see it even better. But this is nothing new to our members of Congress. It's a scandal.
What does it say about the Democratic Party that they enabled this to go forward?
Yeah, no, it's a shocker.
Michael, is the Center for Constitutional Rights doing anything about this?
Well, we've already, actually, I meant to mention, we've won a preservation order already. We represent someone named Majid Khan, who was taken from one of the 14 sites. The two lawyers who have visited him cannot talk to me about what happened to him. For all I know, he was waterboarded. I don't know, because I can't talk to them. I'm speculating. But a lot of people in those sites were treated very, very severely. And what they did, even before this had happened, even before the revelation of the tapes being destroyed of the other people who were waterboarded, they had gone into court to ask for preservation of every document with regard to Majid Khan. They had asked for preservation of every document with regard to Majid Khan. On Tuesday of last week, the court issued a temporary order to the government, which is amazing. Not just the court, the circuit court, with some conservative judges on it, issued an order saying that the CIA and the federal government and the FBI had to preserve all documents relating to torture, abuse, coercive interrogations regarding Majid Khan. They're going to make a final order, I hope, in a few days. But right now, I think the court is nervous about the fact that these documents are being destroyed in front of them.
Today we look at the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act with former National Lawyers Guild President Peter Erlander. Peter says the legislation appears an effort to recreate the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which was a standing commission in the 50s and 60s to root out so-called un-American ideas among political activists. We talk with former National Lawyers Guild President Peter Erlander to identify specifics in this legislation that may be interpreted in ways that breach our constitutional rights.
Professor Peter Erlander, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's glad to be on the show.
Peter, you and I and Michael Ratner and Heidi Boghossian, we're all old friends and comrades. We're all lawyers together in the National Lawyers Guild. You teach law up in Minnesota. You've made it your business to learn about the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. The thing passed 400-6 in the Congress. We don't know much about it, but we don't like it. And we asked you to be on the show to teach us. What's wrong with this act?
Well, Michael, I think the best way to explain is that this bill is should be called the son of HUAC, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee. As you know, existed between 1938 and 1975 with the purpose of ferreting out communists and subversives in the country. We are now creating, according to this bill, a commission that for at least 18 months will be charged with exactly that same task, except that rather using the words communist and subversives, we're calling it violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism. The main idea is this commission is going to be charged with the responsibility of traveling around the country to find out who and where the violent radicals are, which of course is going to mean having hearings, which they're empowered to do. The hearings are part of the legislative body, so contempt of Congress for failing to appear or to testify would be one of the consequences. And then since HUAC was a big factor in American life, we've also had the addition now of the statute that makes it a crime, a felony, to lie to a federal official. And that, of course, is being used in grand juries now. Recently, in two grand jury cases, either the failure to testify or to testify in a way that the prosecution thought was not true has resulted in 10-year sentences because of a terrorism enhancement that's possible after the Patriot Act was passed.
Now, Peter, isn't it true that grand jury investigations are actually unlawful if they are intended to gather political or personal information from an individual rather than actually looking for elements of a crime?
The question is how one determines that that might be true. Of course, technically, it's incorrect to use governmental powers for political reasons generally. That was one of the reasons, of course, that the Smith Act was struck down. But we also know that material support for terrorism recently has been held up, even though it's not entirely clear what that is. The point is that the definition of violent radicalization means the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purposes of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change.
Yeah. It covers animal liberation. It covers me sitting down in the streets to stop Haitians being deported to Haiti. It stops going over the fence at the World Trade Center. It's anybody who thinks that stuff. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you are wrong, Michael. In fact, I think that it's quite clear that the demonstrators at the Seattle WTO demonstrations would have been covered by this and would allow hearings to take place in Seattle to find out who those people were. And then, of course, we get into the problems that we know from HUAC with respect to the failure to cooperate or to name names. This would apply, for example, to suspicions that someone in this commission might have as to what's going on in a particular mosque, for example. It would be necessary, I would guess, to talk to everyone in the mosque to find out who are the radicals among the people in the mosque.
It's a bill so far passed, what, 400 and
406?
Yeah, it passed the House 404-6. It's a Democratic bill, Democrat Party bill. Representative James Harmon from California proposed it. Mainly Democratic co-sponsors, and only six congresspeople voted against it, what, two Republicans and four Democrats. It was pushed by the leadership of the House as a non-controversial measure. I talked with Keith Ellison, of course, he's a member of Congress and also a Lawyers Guild member, who voted for it without realizing exactly what it meant, because part of the bill also calls for the establishment of kind of an intellectual think tank as part of the Homeland Security Department, and that I have no significant objection to. But
I talked to Congressman Nadler from New York, and he voted for it.
Yep.
And he said he looks to this congressman named Scott, sort of vets these things, and who has 100% voting on civil rights and, you know, terrorism issues that is good. And he voted for it, and it never went through the committee, the bill. And so it just came up one day and went right through because, as you said, it's non-controversial.
That was the way it was presented to the rank and file by the leadership, I understand.
But, Peter, a version of this bill is going to get passed by the Senate. Bush will certainly sign it. Now we're going to have this as the law. And it strikes me, as just as you explained how communist and subversive business that HUAC conducted really was a weapon against social change in the United States, this is going to be used in the same way. Wouldn't you think so?
I think it's unavoidable that it would be used in the same way. Now, the good thing about this, if there is something good, is that it has an 18-month sunset clause when there's supposed to be a final report as to what the commission has ferreted out through its hearings around the country. If one understands how bureaucracies work, particularly during this time in our history, I think it's almost inconceivable that the commission will decide to disband itself after 18 months.
Well, Patriot Act had a sunset provision.
Right.
Even when that one went in, I said, I've never actually seen a law sunset, to be honest. I mean, I don't think it happens. Yeah, there's a little debate when it happens and they extend it.
You know, and the point that Heidi made about possibly the misuse of this would eventually be declared unconstitutional, we only have to look at how difficult it is to deal with Guantanamo and how long it takes to resolve these constitutional issues over time. Even if it's eventually found to be unconstitutional, and which, of course, the HUAC was never found to be unconstitutional, we end up with a situation where we're maybe a decade down the line.
Oh, I don't think that should even be an issue here. I mean, I don't think the court challenge is. I think it's meaningless, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Peter, one concern that some people have who know a little bit about this is how it's going to impact internet activities. And we've seen with a couple of animal rights activists, well, the Shack 7, for example, they are all doing prison sentences for running a website that didn't actually call for any action, but people responded emotionally to it. Do you think this could make government prosecutions of things like internet activity more easy?
Well, I think it makes the investigations much easier because it doesn't require suspicion of criminal activity to call people before this commission. The commission is charged with figuring out who has violent radical thoughts or who is a homegrown terrorist. So we could conceivably call anyone before this committee to find out whether they are or whether someone else they know is. So it's a return to are you now or have you ever been sorts of questions, which then, of course, could lead to prosecutions quite easily.
So, Peter, if the Democratic Party in the person of Jane Harman and others proposed this thing and they all voted for it, what's the difference on these questions between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party? Who's out there helping us? Who's defending us? It's frustrating.
I think the bill itself doesn't talk about the contempt powers of Congress, and it doesn't talk about the ability for people to be prosecuted for lying to federal officials who these bodies, these members would be. So it isn't clear from the face of the bill what the real impact is. And if you don't remember HUAC, and that was 30 years ago now, you wouldn't understand the real threat that this bill presents. It's not on its face that it looks to be difficult, and this is a failure to remember history. I think it's quite clear that when we're talking about either Republicans or Democrats, we're not talking about parties that are fundamentally opposed to the notion of the U.S. empire, which I think is increasingly understood now and appears in the New York Times regularly as a subject for discussion. I don't think there's a disagreement that there has to be a tightening up of law enforcement and surveillance within the United States. It's just a question of degree and method.
Peter, thank you very much for articulating this for us. We've been talking to law professor Peter Erlander out in Minnesota. He knows quite a lot about the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. It's been passed by the House. It'll probably get passed by the Senate, and we're going to be laboring under it.
What can people who are concerned about this do?
Well, it can be blocked in the Senate, theoretically at least. And I'm not sure whether there's any way to encourage Congress people to somehow call the measure back, but I'm pressuring Keith Ellison to try and do that.
If it does pass and is signed into law, do you think this will have a chilling effect on politically active individuals?
I can't see how it can have any other effect, because if this commission is charged with the responsibility of figuring out who among us are those who have violently radical thoughts, which is what they're supposed to be doing, the only way to do that is to call people who associate with folks who might somehow do something more than voting and asking them who's dangerous. I don't see another way for this commission to proceed.
Well, I guess that means that all of us in the Guild and on this radio show would fall into that category.
Well, the definition is quite startling, and it's particularly directed at people born, living in, folks who are United States persons and permanent residents and citizens. So this isn't like some of those other measures that we've seen that apply differently to people who are of foreign origin. This is a direct assault on civil liberties here, I'm afraid.
Peter, it's been great to have you on, and we look forward to talking about this in a few months and to seeing how it actually plays out.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad you're making this an issue, as I think the American people need to understand it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we're going to be speaking with Marnia Lazreg, who has just written Torture in the Twilight of Empire, from Algiers to Baghdad. Marnia is a professor of sociology at Hunter, and recently she was on the staff at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, an impressive place. Einstein was there. She's written a brilliant book, Torture in the Twilight of Empire, compares the French colonialists trying to hang on to their dying empire in Algeria with the United States trying to hang on to its in Iraq. Torture, she says, is a natural outgrowth of an empire in decline. She traces back the most horrifying of torture techniques from the medieval Christian church through the French Empire right up to Bush's doorstep. We're grateful to have her with us this morning. Marnia Lazreg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
All of us have in hand your just published book, Torture and the Twilight of Empire, from Algiers to Baghdad. I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you here in the studio with us, Marnia. I gave your book to Michael Saturday night when we were with our wives at a little French restaurant eating dinner. And Michael stopped eating, and he picked up your book, and he dropped out of the conversation for 20 minutes.
No, it's utterly remarkable. I mean, it really gives a context. I mean, even the title is just so provocative.
Torture and the Twilight of Empire. It seems to me that you've captured precisely what's going on, that America has an empire, that it's in its declining years, and that's why it's using torture. And you show what happened with the decline of the French Empire and the torture that they put on the Algerian and some French people then. And then in your last chapter, you make the parallels with Abu Ghraib and Gitmo and what the Americans are doing. Am I right? Do you believe that the United States is in its decline and that's why it's used?
First of all, you know, I'm also very honored to be here, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, I mean, what attracted me was precisely this notion. Why is it that torture becomes so appealing, so attractive at the end of an empire? And I was first intrigued by the French Empire because it was closer to me.
Well, you're Algerian.
In Algeria, and I grew up during the Algerian War. I was, when it ended, I was just, coming, out of the lycée. And one day as a young girl, working as an intern in a government office, I ran into this young man who was 25 years old who worked, in the mail office. And he complained to me that I was giving him too many, letters, to register. And then he said to me, "Look at me. The French destroyed my testicles, and now I am registering the mail day in, day out." I was absolutely transfixed. I remember I was just coming out of the lycée, and I didn't know what to say to him, but I do remember the look in his eyes. It was so vivid in my memory, and I can see it, still now. And then in the summer of 2001, I see in a bookstore in Algiers, side by side, the book written by the former general Paul Osares, who had been, an expert at torture, and he was actually the architect of the whole torture system during the Battle of Algiers. Next to it, there was this book written by an Algerian woman who had been tortured for 2.5 months on the heights of Algiers in one of the semi-legal torture centers, the Centre Trier de Transit, triage and transit centers, and started telling myself, what's going on here? How could this man describe torture in detail, how he did it, and never for 1 minute in any page express any regret? If anything, at the end of the book, he said, "I do not regret what I have done. I simply wish that, others will not have to do it." So it occurred to me that that must be something about torture, that torture must have a meaning beyond itself. Is torture truly about torture, or is it about something else? Now, in doing archival research at the Service Historique de l'Armée de Terre, which has changed its name now to Service Historique de la Défense, in doing archival research, it became clearer and clearer to me that there was something going on here. Even though you don't have one big file that says torture, you had to very often to read between the lines. But I was struck by the manner in which, you know, generals, you know, very, you know, significant figures in the military establishment were defending the Algerian war, defending the repressive methods that they were engaged into. Then, of course, I put things together and I, you know, remembered the theorist of empire and realized that, in effect, the colonial ventures, the imperial ventures, acquire greater clarity, a crystalline clarity, when the empire reaches its end. Because at that point, then you have all of the advocates of colonialism and those who were its pillars, you know, throughout history, who look back and want to define in very, very clear terms why the colonial imperial ventures are necessary. In the case of France, it was, well, at first it was to, you know, the civilizing mission, but that ideology was a little bit tired. You know, no one was really believing in it, not least of all, you know, the young French, you know, conscripts. So they brought up something, you know, more actual at the time. Remember, this is the time, this is during the Cold War. Well, international communism wants to destabilize Western democracies, and we have to really stand up to them. So you're fighting international communism. With the U.S., then the Abu Ghraib, you know, nightmare, you know, came to the fore. And I realized, as I would hear people talking, the generals in Iraq, Mr. Rumsfeld, and, you know, the whole, you know, group, it seemed to me like I had heard it all before. I could literally, in some situations, I could finish the sentence for them because I already read that before. Yeah. So I realized, my gosh, the similarities are so striking.
When the French were in Algeria, of course, it was right after, I mean, they were their occupiers, but the yes. war really began after, I guess, after Dien Bien Phu, yeah. which I think our listeners know was the end of the French occupation.
Right, 1954, May 1954.
May 1954, and right. so they're holding on to one of their last colonies, really.
Absolutely, and
And so
yes.
you look at, then you go right. to Iraq, and of course we're in there now, at a place in which the U.S. is no longer going to be the dominant world power
right.
for the future. I mean, right. we're going to have China, we're going to have some other countries out
right.
there.
Right.
So that's one of the parallels, I think, that you're drawing
yes,
here.
Yes, that's very true. At the same time, remember, that document that had been formulated by Wolfowitz, you
yes.
know, Fife, and, you know, all those people. And it had been formulated prior to Bush II.
Mention,
you know,
what that document is
yeah.
for our listeners.
America in the 21st Century. And it did say that America, now that, you know, there is only one superpower, we have to project, you know, this image, you know, of force, and we have to be able to actually, you know, define the parameters within which, you know, what is permissible politically and what is not, you know, will be. In essence, you know, maybe the comparison is a little bit, you know, far-fetched, but it's like what the French generals were doing, and also, you know, all of the intellectuals, you know, military intellectuals who were helping the generals to devise, you know, their strategies. It's similar to what they did. The document, America in the 21st Century, is really crystallization, a clarification of, you know, American power at a time when one superpower, you know, could not really operate, you know, as, you know, successfully as when you had two superpowers.
Interesting.
We're speaking to listeners that just have tuned in with Marnia Lazreg, who's written a very, very good book called Torture and the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad. Just came out. Princeton University Press put it out. We all would recommend that our listeners read it. It's the most profound book on torture that we know of. Marnia has been explaining how torture comes in with the twilight of empires in the French Empire that she studied in Algeria, and she makes the connection with the American Empire. One thing that's puzzled us since we started looking into this ourselves, Marnia, is that torture doesn't yield particularly useful information. Nonetheless, they do it. You say in your book that they do it for reasons of power and for psychological reasons, and that they do it against a colonial people, that it's kind of an inherently racist practice as well. I wanted to ask you about that and also about the sexual aspect of torture.
Yes, that is a very important question, especially the last part. Torture fulfills a number of functions, you know, for the people who do the torturing and for the institutions that allow the torture to take place. Torture is sexual. The core of torture is sexual. I don't remember reading a document, you know, a confession written by former torturers in which, you know, sex was not, you know, part of torture. And actually, it makes sense because, you know, sex and sexuality, you know, is part of, you know, individual's identity. If you play with the genitals of a man, you're degrading him beyond, you know, belief. If you rape him, of course, you're degrading him even more. And this is what happened in the torture chamber. And this is why I think that when the whole discourse about, you know, what constitutes, you know, torture and what doesn't, what kind of pain rises to the level of torture and what doesn't, is absolutely non-productive of any kind of understanding. And it is also very wrong and at odds with the actual concrete situation of torture. Torture is not about simply inflicting degrees of pain on a powerless person tied, you know, to a board, as the French did, or tied to a chair. It is really a situation that's overlaid with a number of meanings. And these meanings are political, cultural, social, you name it. The torture cannot be divorced from what I would call the situation within which it takes place. And when I say situation, I don't mean all of, you know, the Iraq situation or all of the Guantanamo situation. I mean the situation within the torture chamber. What you have is two individuals, but they're not facing each other as individuals, you know, two men or one man and a woman. They're facing each other as bearers of different national histories, political affiliations, beliefs, cultural understandings. And these, you know, these overlays, if you will, conceal the fact that from the torture that he's actually inflicting unimaginable pain on a powerless individual. The issue of powerlessness is very important because what distinguishes the torture situation from any other situation is that you have an individual who cannot fight back, completely, totally rendered powerless. It's the reduction of the individual to simply a thing, a surface on which, you know, you play out, you know, you implement all kinds, you know, of techniques. But at the same time, what you're doing it, while you're doing it, you are actually engaged in a battle, not with that particular person, but with something larger than that person. And this explains why, for example, Paul Osares, you know, would be thinking about the Battle of Valmy as he is about, you know, to do, you know, his, you know,
he's torturing
the French
general
people.
Who
yes, Paul Osares, the self-confessed general who even in his late 80s would not acknowledge that what he did was wrong. He had absolutely no ethical compunction, inhibition, even, you know, in his, you know, later years when he talks about torture.
So go back, he's in the room with all
yes,
of...
before he gets into the room, he's right. Thinking about all these things. Right. And the Battle of Valmy, I mean, I forgot, it was 1793. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a long time ago. And he's in Algeria in 1956, you know, in Eastern Algeria. He's head of, you know, special services. And actually, the title of his book in French is called Service Spéciaux, meaning special services. It was translated into English as the Battle of the Casbah, which actually, and Alec here is very, very right on this. You know, it was not a battle. It was not the French, you know, paratroopers facing another army. It was really the French paratroopers assaulting a civilian population that lived in the area of Algiers, the old town called the Casbah. Alec makes this point very, very well.
We're talking about Henri Alec, was waterboarded, right. And we've had on
right.
this show.
Right, 1793. Okay. I mean, this is, you know, quite, you know, quite old. Right. But at the same time, this is part of a pattern. The French officers, you know, colonels, you lieutenants, in the archives, I would come across, things such. They would talk about, Vercingetorix. I mean, this was way back, the beginning. This was a goal, before it became, modern France. For example, one way of killing someone who has been tortured so badly didn't break. Sometimes, he did break. And you didn't want him to, because the scars were so severe, and you didn't want him to talk about what happened, or because you didn't like the way he resisted you, because there was also that contest of wills between the torturer and the tortured. One way of getting rid of those people was to send them out to fetch wood. La corvée de bois. Probably the best translation would be the wood detail. But la corvée de bois is really something, that used to happen, in the medieval, period. So even the old French past, the old French history insinuated itself in the nitty-gritty of the war, and especially in torture, which tells you something about the larger battle, that you find also within in the torture chamber itself, that this is a confrontation between, and the French like the term, between two civilizations. So you have the French torturer
who represents... States likes the term,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah. You have the representative of the Western civilization, and you have the tortured person, the victim who is going to be tortured also, who actually represents, barbarism, backwardness, so forth. Actually, this is very, there is a good parallel. I mean, the parallels between the U.S. and France and Algeria in the 1950s are really very compelling, even though the situations are not really alike. What you had in Algeria is a predominantly Muslim population. That's a fact, that, one cannot wish away. And that had some sort of relevance, within in what happened, in the torture chamber. Because, torturers would say, well, because they were Muslims, we thought that they would be, humiliated more, if you stripped them of their clothes, or if you stripped them and their wives or daughters of their clothes. And then, of course, all sorts of sexual things, were, imposed upon, members of the same family, incestuous situations. And that has not been talked about. It has not been written about, and you don't see it in the confessions written by the French, the former torturers. Yeah.
But draw this out. I think you draw it out because you started by talking about this clash of civilization almost that happens within the torture chamber in Algeria. Yeah. And how do you make that parallel to today?
Well, I mean the whole explanation of the war in Iraq, the whole fight against quote unquote the insurgency is, establish a democracy in Iraq, and explaining that, to establish a democracy, you actually have, to do certain things. You have to extirpate out of the society all of these subversive elements. And we are always told that, they're really, foreigners. They come from outside of Iraq, which is a good way of making the war popular. But one would need to know whether on the ground you're really dealing only with outside elements, or whether there is not a homegrown opposition to, the invasion. Even the guys who are on our side, the Kurds, we don't tend to think about them as Muslims, but we're always, outlining the fact that you have the Shia and the Sunni. And the Sunni were the bad guys. And in fact, we are helping, the bad guys on the Shia side, to control, the government. And we're also partitioning the country, along sectarian lines. So it's not ethnic, really, that's sectarian. They are Shia and Sunni, and the only ethnic, really, is the Kurds.
One of the things that you mention that is especially compelling right now in light of the CIA destruction of torture videotapes is the taking of photographs of victims and how that, you mention, it makes the shame indelible and can be viewed by the torturers in the future. How do you think that's adding to this whole degradation process?
Yes, I think that is also a very important question. You know, in the modern torture situation, and that happened also during the French counter, you know, subversive, you know, strategy. But the point is that the camera becomes a tool of torture, because what you're doing is actually fixing the image of what happened. And that image can be very degrading, you know, to the victim. And what can you do when you do that? What are you going to do with it? In the case of Abu Ghraib, what you're going to be doing, you know, I would assume, is not only for fun showing it, you know, putting it on the screensaver, but also you can then go back to that person, tell them either you will be working for us, you know, as a spy or whatever, or we will show this image, you know, to your neighborhood, to your family, to your friends, and you will be forever discredited. So it's a means of, you know, coercion for making people do things for you that they would not normally do. Beyond that, I think, you know, it's, you know, the latest, you know, the destruction of the tapes, you know, has an additional meaning in the sense that it shows that torture was practiced against the law by the CIA. And what goes under the label of severe torture was actually practiced. The reason for which apparently the tapes, you know, had been destroyed, I think, you know, is not compelling. You know, CIA operatives, who is, you know, are the tapes going to be shown, you know, to the Qaeda operatives? You know, how would they know where this person works, you know, in the hierarchy of the CIA? I mean, it's theoretically plausible, but not compelling. And so, yes.
We agree with that.
So why were they destroyed?
Evidence, and it's done. It was done again. There is another dimension to this, and that happened during the Algerian War, also. And that is that, you know, people within the CIA took it upon themselves, you know, to flaunt the law, and that's what happened also, you know, during the, you know, the Algerian War. You just did things which were, you know, essentially illegal, but, you know, one officer would take the responsibility for doing them. It's, you know, burning down villages, you know, was not really something that was, you know, approved, but it was tolerated. And reprisals were part and parcel of the repressive war.
We're speaking with Marnia Lasreg, who's written Torture in the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad. Princeton University Press just put it out. It's a very good book to get, Torture in the Twilight of Empire. You write about historically how the church had not resisted torture, in fact, even endorsed it and practiced it, going all the way back to the Middle Ages. It's curious to me that you have these self-professed Christians in office now who are also promoting it. What goes through these people's minds? How do you explain that?
Well, the history of the church with respect to torture is not a very clean history. And remember, during the medieval period, you know, the church, you know, was actually presiding over the ordeals, you know, ceremonies. You would have, you know, the person who was going to be subjected, for example, to the ordeal by burning the hand in a big cauldron full of very hot, you know, oil. It would be a pageant. It would be a pageant, you know, like the person would be accompanied by a number of others. They would be singing Ave Marias, and then the priest would be officiating over this, and the person would have the hand dunked, you know, into the cauldron, you know, full of boiling oil, if oil can boil, and it comes out. And remember also the persecution of people who did not they were Christians, but they were not really entirely in agreement, you know, with the established Christian church, you know, in France, for example, the persecution, you know, of the people in Albi in the south of France, the Templars, they were tortured. There is a very long history to torture and the Christian church. It reflects, you know, this, you know, historical understanding of, you know, what Islam is, and it connotes also this fear of, you know, some, you know, terrible things that are happening and that are committed, you know, by people who come, you know, from Muslim countries. But it has always been very interesting to me to see how the Catholic right in France during the Algerian War, how they explained, you know, the use of repressive methods, you know, including torture. And they really argued that there was a severe, real, concrete, identifiable threat, which was the Islamic threat. And especially now that some Muslim countries were getting their political independence. So Indonesia had become independent. Egypt, you know, had achieved, you know, its independence from Britain in 1952. And so they felt, you know, that there was really a resurgence, you know, of Islam. And now France really had to fight the Muslim resurgence. What is interesting is that against the law, illegally, the French military in Algeria allowed Cité Catholique, which was this far-right group, to organize, you know, within the army. And they had actually set up a number of cells. But they were very well organized. They had the technique, you know, social psychological techniques, and they wanted to convince the conscripts who were not too keen on the war. You know, this is, you know, the 1950s, you know, these young men were thrown into this country. They were told these are French citizens, and they wrote in some of them in their memoirs. Can you imagine French citizens who first couldn't speak French, and second, who were so poor that it was embarrassing, you know, to have anything to do with them?
You know what it reminds me? You know, when you talked about going into the interrogation booth or the French general who goes in, I guess when an American soldier, of course, we have our whole evangelical movement within our military and right-wing Christian, and we've painted the Muslims essentially as the devils. Even the president has done that to a certain measure and the others. And you go into that booth, into that interrogation room, and you have 9/11 on your mind. You have the papers drumming into you. You have this clash of civilization supposedly going on. And so you're talking about a parallel with what you're saying that's so close as to be as to be really frightening when you read the amount of torture that went on in your book.
And on this chapter of the church and torture, you'd be interested to know that in 1958, it was a priest, a chaplain, Father de la Rue, who wrote an essay actually justifying torture. He was a chaplain with paratroopers in the eastern mountains of Algeria, in the Grand Kabylie, which had been hit very hard, you know, during the war. And the title of his essay was "The Lesser of Two Evils." And imagine, connect with Michael Ignatieff, "The Lesser Evil."
Michael Ignatieff ran a Harvard Human Rights Clinic.
That's right.
But essentially came out with a justification.
We've been speaking with Marnia Lazreg, who's written Torture in the Twilight of Empire. Princeton University Press just put it out. We've been having this discussion and all of us learning and really teaching ourselves about what the United States has been doing since 9/11. And this book pulls it together. It gives us a historical perspective.
I mean, the real point for me is that one you make over and over. It's not an abstraction. You just can't put on a wall, "Don't torture." It comes out of particular circumstances. It's in an interrogation room, and it comes out of the broader historical issues that are going on. It's really critical.
You cannot break it down into component parts and say you're going to have this particular technique. This would be allowed, and this one would not be allowed. That's completely at odds with what happens in the real concrete situation of torture. And also, it's putting so much power of constraint and restraints in the hands of the torturer. Is he going to look at the manual? This one is going to be approved. This one is not going to be approved. It simply doesn't make sense. And first of all, torture doesn't begin, you know, just with that, you know, particular technique and end with it. It doesn't at all. It's the whole, the softening up, and the softening up can begin with slaps, you know, given, you know, to a person by a huge man, and you have the prisoner, and you have two big paratroopers, you know, going at it, and they send the person back and forth to each other as if this were punching bag. And the slaps, you know, for many people actually lost, you know, the hearing just from the slaps.
That's something that's authorized by the American government.
But you see, that's the thing. You know, it's authorized, but what is authorized is not the technique. What is authorized is torture. because there is no way for you to check, you know, what is going to be, you know, meted out, you know, to the person. And that's the wrong way of thinking about torture. Torture is the whole situation. Either, you know, you approve the whole situation, and that's what you're doing when you're saying you approve just 1 second, or you just do not approve it.
Well, this has been an amazing interview, Marnia, and the book is remarkable. I mean, it just gives such a depth to an issue that is just treated just ridiculously in this country. Just ridiculous. But thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you so much, Marnia.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.